Good morning and welcome to our podcast today, Company Buybacks, Shareholder Disputes and Minority Discounts on Shareholder Value. My name is Kevin Upper and I'm the founder and chair of Avondale Corporate. I'm joined by Stuart Millington, who is our head of strategy. Our podcast today should be about 30-35 minutes long, and we're going to be examining the increasing trend we're seeing for shareholder fatigue. Shareholder fatigue is essentially where the shareholders no longer share the same vision, and it's starting to show itself in boardroom disputes and a lack of vision for the business. The natural conclusion to that may be a company buyout or company buyback, where one buyout shareholder buys out the other. But before you do that, the first step is to look at arbitration. What is causing the fatigue? Often it could be a change in the risk profile of the sellers or the shareholders, or it could be a different motivation in terms of the lifestyles that they want to lead. Or it quite simply could be that they have a different understanding of the market dynamics or metrics. So to examine shareholder disputes, often it's easy to go back and look at the roots or the foundations that are leading to that dispute. And or lack of alignment or fatigue as we see it. So of course, we do want to talk about company buybacks and how they work, how if you can't get over the dispute, how you can actually mechanically buy the other person out. And I'll go through that, and then Stuart, I'm going to circle back and bring you in to discuss the fatigue issue that we see. So if you can't get past the fatigue, you can't create the joint motivation, what do you do? Well, naturally, the end conclusion is typically one or other has to buy each other out. Often that can be fraught with difficulties, mainly because the emotions have got high by this point and there's a lack of alignment in how to agree that, not necessarily each side happy with whoever's buyer and seller. And of course, you've got the usual difference that whoever buys is normally paying too much and whoever sells is normally getting not enough. And so you've got to bridge that gap. Company buybacks are a really clever mechanism that enables you to do that. Company buyback is where you use the company's own reserves to buy out one or other of the shareholders, and you can do that also with minority shareholders. The beauty, of course, of that is that it's not income that you've had to earn yourself and pay dividend tax on or income tax on. It's the company's reserves that are actually financing the deal. Now, often when you have disputes and those disputes have deteriorated, they can actually then very much focus around valuation. And the point that we're making here, that if you can't bridge the gap on valuation, the tax breaks can actually be really effective to bridge that gap. So company buybacks are from the company's reserves and therefore very tax effective, as they're not got to, the individuals haven't necessarily got to go and raise the money themselves and or haven't had to pay dividend tax on taking that money out. One other method for the buyout or buyback, and again, we see this in disputes, so before you end up in courts and arbitration on the actual finance evaluation, another method is a company buyback, perhaps backed by either a pension or income trail out agreement. Now, pension or income, of course, is corporation tax deductible. So again, you can use the tax breaks to bridge that gap if you've got one on valuation. I'm going full circle to this. Obviously, these are technical areas. We need to value the business, and please see our guide on valuations. But there is an established precedent that minority shareholders can be valued at a discount, particularly those below 25.1%, which is where you can veto special resolutions or sales. So obviously shares that are less than that are actually arguably valued at less than 100%. Now, if you've got a good shareholders agreement, it may define those shares as being 100% and they must be valued at that, or some articles may do. But if you haven't got a quality shareholders agreement, then that discounted principle may also apply. But again, that's one of the reasons why people then end up in dispute, because, you know, yes, they haven't got a shared vision for the business, they've decided on a buyout, but the gap is simply too big in terms of the value. And our argument is often the tax breaks on those buyouts are not understood, and can be a material way to reduce the debate or defuse the argument on valuation, which can be a central point. When we're getting into negotiation on company buybacks or valuations, what we often have to do is point out the mutually assured distraction between the parties. So very, very often, neither of them fully understand the law as far as minority shareholding is concerned. They also don't fully understand the valuation metrics, and they've each got a different perception of their leverage in the room on this negotiation. And as a result of that, they don't know, you know, it's all too emotional. They're not looking at it commercially, and they don't know the logic of how those negotiations would actually play out in a court. Once you point those out, often you can avoid the court because you then end up in a position where the parties understand where each other are. But that's company buybacks and minority valuations. I can't obviously give you, we've got a short time this morning, I can't give you a full insight into full company valuation metrics. Please see our guide and download that on our website if you've got any questions. But I want to go right back to how you avoid shareholder fatigue in the first place, or if it's starting to show that lack of vision between the shareholders, what can you do to avoid even having to go to the buyout position? And how do you create a reset and a revitalization within that alignment within the shareholders? So as I say, I'm joined by Stuart Millington, Head of Strategy. Stuart, you're out on the road quite a lot meeting shareholders. Has shareholder fatigue increased in your opinion, particularly post-COVID?
Yeah, I think with most companies, you know, as people get older, especially where there's an age difference between the shareholders, you get shareholder fatigue. It's almost inevitable. There's a point where one party wants to leave earlier than the other party, or wants the business to take a lower risk, wants to stop growing it so quickly. You know, you've got the other party wants to borrow a lot of money to take it to the next stage to do an acquisition, and one shareholder is quite happy with the current situation. You've got that. And the other thing is you've got the complete unforeseen thing that all of a sudden one of the shareholders becomes ill or even passes away, and you know the situation's forced. So it's almost, I think, where you've got multiple shareholding and where there's more than one shareholder who's got a significant percentage of the actual company, it's inevitable that something like this is going to arise. And therefore, I think it's so surprising that in the early days of when the company is either formed or when it starts getting traction, they don't have a conversation that says, you know, what's going to happen if we decide we want to go in different directions, or what's going to happen if one of us drops down dead? What, you know, what, how are we going to look after the wives and the children and all this sort of stuff?
You're pointing at the shareholders agreement there, Stuart, aren't you?
It's interesting. People set up a company and they sit down with this solicitor and says, right, we want you to sign the Articles of Association and there's a few other documents. And the shareholders agreement is just one of those documents. And I think they've got to remember is it's the shareholders agreement. It's actually got a role. And you should in there be covering off things, what's going to happen in the end of death or disability, what's going to happen in terms of we want to go different directions, and you know who's going to buy the company out. I mean, the other thing is when you get two shareholders together and one wants to go one direction and one wants to go the other direction, so they both want to stay within the business but want to take a different direction, you've got both in the situation where they want to buy the other out. So it's not always that one wants to leave and one wants to stay. You've got all this conflict going on, and inevitably, it's hardly ever seen the situation where it doesn't get emotional. And you know, your acronym of mutually assured destruction, MAD, is what it looks like from the outside in, because you see what happened is the shareholders stopped putting their energy into running the business, and they start putting their energy into going to war. And that's what it looks like when you look at it.
So one of the things that we see often, Stuart, and again, it is related to shareholder fatigue, is where people are working incredibly hard, particularly as business models are changing so rapidly. So they're up against the coalface, putting the hours in, and they're feeling that they're the one carrying the burden in the business, but missing the point that business strategy should be separating employment to shareholding, and very often in smaller companies or where we specialize, emerging mid-market, they don't do that. They don't blend the two. So it's perception that, you know, we take our money by dividend, we take low income, But actually, again, that can be an easy solution. Is if you've got one side that is carrying more weight, then pay them more. It's quite straightforward. Do you see that done very often? Do you find that arrangement?
Well, do you know what? I've actually seen, it's astonishing. You get people, they come together and they're sort of equals in the company. But it's interesting, over the years as the company grows, you tend to find quite often that the people's skill levels changes. Just like in any company, sometimes people thrive and keep on handling their responsibilities as the company grows, and other people struggle to handle the additional responsibility. It's the same when the directors and the shareholders are there. You often find that one becomes the managing director and is doing really well. You'll tend to find another one is that they're gently trying to move them into a less demanding position because they're struggling with the size of the company. And the classic case is when they're a small business and they have to do things, and they're doing. Now it's no longer a small business and they have to manage people. And quite often people can't make the transition between doing and managing people, and then just not very good managers. But the original deal was, you know, there's four shareholders, they own 25% each. They're all on the same salary, except one of them is now accepting a much more junior position. One's a managing director. And sometimes one of the tension points is the managing director is being paid twice what one of the other directors are being paid, and they don't accept, they can't understand or accept the difference between salary and shareholding. And that causes a conflict in terms of doing it that way.
You've reminded me there of the Peters principle, that people get promoted to their highest level of incompetence. And that's certainly the same for owner, worker, shareholders, isn't it? You know, particularly if it's 10, 15 years in. The business model may have changed, the cycle may have changed, but also the size of it, so the skill set has changed. But rarely do people spend enough money on training or upskilling. So again, that can be one of the challenges, I think. So one way around the shareholder fatigue is to do an objective review, understand the marketplace and where the business is, and actually, you know, points-based those skills of the shareholders, but also risk profile of the board and the decision-making. So try and create some objectivity so people can understand where they actually are rather than the emotions of how they've got to where they are. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, especially around the risk point, you tend to find when there's a disagreement over where the company should go, people think that they're arguing about the direction. What they're actually arguing about is how they feel. Because you've got somebody who's got quite a high risk profile, then the suggestion of what they do next commercially is quite satisfying and comfortable. But if you've got someone who's got a low risk profile, they're really uncomfortable with it, not because necessarily it's a bad business idea, but because they've just got a low risk profile, it's just them. And what actually happens if they don't have that discussion you've just described, they don't get to the point of realizing they're not discussing actually the business proposition, they're discussing what their level of comfort is with various levels of risk in terms of going forward. So where one's saying, look, we can borrow this amount of money from the bank or whatever, and the other one's going, oh, I really don't like the feeling of this at all. So the way it sort of falls out. But what's interesting more and more is that as the company gets to a certain size and people are getting older and things like that, that the number of people that don't sit down and say, okay, let's have a conversation now about what happens if one of us gets ill, one of us dies, what if we want to go in different directions? Because on things like death and illness and things like that, you can take out key man insurance to cover it off. So while the business has got the money in there, they can agree in the cold light of day when it's not in front of them what's going to happen. And it does sound strange, but the good analogy is it's like a couple getting married and having to do a prenuptial agreement, which is, you know, oh yes, darling, I love you, but just in case we fall out, let's agree who's going to have what at the end of it. And it's the same thing when you've got sort of directors sitting together, they own the company together, but it's saying, okay, if in the event that we fall out, right, and decide we want to go in different directions, or one becomes ill, you know, what's going to happen to that person's shares? What's going to happen to the salary? You know, if they say that they have a stroke, they can't work, right? So is the company going to keep on paying them a salary to look after them? Or are they just going to get dividends? And what's the policy as well in terms of, if you think of the three ways people tend to take money out of the business, there's the salary, bonuses, and dividends.
It's interesting, Stuart, because I've actually got one very successful business. The guy's doubled the profits from $500,000 to $1 million, and his partner's had a critical illness, can't work. And he's been more than happy to keep him on. I've been saying for years, buy him out, but they don't want to. So everybody's different on this. I think that's really important as well, isn't it? Is actually, you know, people's lifetime cycles and life aspirations, if you like, post-COVID has changed, and everyone views money slightly differently. So again, we sort of talk about getting clear on risk profile between people, but getting clearer on personal aspirations between people as well is actually quite important, because, you know, if somebody, one person's happy with $1 million, but the other needs 10 million, that's not necessarily risk profile. It's also their vision of themselves. And often that moves apart.
Yeah, I mean, I got involved with one not long ago. And the issue was, the guy who founded the company and got it to a certain level couldn't get much further. And then he brought in a fellow director and he put some money in and he ended up with 20% of the equity. And they'd always agreed that if the new guy could deliver certain numbers, he could have 45% of the company. And then it got to a point, there was about a 30-year age difference between them. So the guy who was the majority shareholder wanted to retire. But there was a big conflict about how many shares the other one should have and all the rest of it. And they talked about all of this, and it sounds amazing, but they hadn't really written it down in writing, so there was absolute clarity in the two of them. And it ended up actually getting to a point where it started getting emotional. And the crazy thing is, if it gets emotional, it does damage the business. Because these were the two directors and shareholders that owned the company, were running the company, and unless they were focused on the company, it was going to start going away. I mean, they're going to lose business, lose profit. So the idea of doing this is really important. But the other thing is, as well, in law, there's certain mechanisms there you can make use of. So the other thing you get is, you know, you get somebody who owns 80% of the company and they get an offer and he wants to sell, but the 20% shareholder doesn't want to sell because he's only got 20% and he thinks he should have 40%. So there's things called drag along and tag along rights. So drag along rights is that you put in the shareholders agreement and the shareholders agree, which means if the majority shareholder wants to sell, he can actually force all the minority shareholders to sell, but they have to get the same price. They all get the same price on the shares. And tag along is the exact opposite, is that you've got the majority shareholder actually selling out and you as a minority shareholder can force the situation so you're not left behind. So they have to buy your shares as well at the same rate. So those things are quite important. And the other one is that people just are ignorant of the law sometimes. The worst one of all is where it's 50-50 and they fall out. I was involved in one that was very, very difficult. Two guys formed a company, they were 50-50. One put up all the money, but the other one took a huge reduction in salary and did all the work to build, grow the business. And it got to a 50-50 situation. But over the years, they'd had board meetings and they'd taken in turn to be chairman. So they'd both been chairman. Because normally in a 50-50 situation, the chairman has the casting vote and can decide. But in this instance, as they'd both been chairman, there was no casting vote. And as you watch them go to battle, and it just got worse and worse. You imagine the old analogy, which is, you know, when you're in a hole, the trick is to stop digging. And all these two guys were digging a bigger hole every time they met.
We're back to MAD, aren't we? Mutual Assured Destruction. But yeah, I mean, again, for me, one of the points on that is how you get past that is you have to point out the leverage that both sides have as well. So in 50-50, it's harder, but often if you've got a minority, for example, look, yeah, appreciate you don't want to sell it, appreciate you want the value of this, we're going to turn the dividend off and therefore it's got no value. Now what? You know, that's one of the weapons that, you know, the key shareholders may have to pull them along if they don't want to sort of drag and dang them. But it can sound quite brutal, but I actually find sometimes that getting people to stare down the barrel so that they understand, if you like, the weapons each side has got is a really good way of then creating the fresh perspective of, maybe we don't want to keep this debate going on and this discussion going on. Because, say, if it can't be brought out or you can't create alignment, if you go to the courts will ignore the emotion. They're very much driven by the paper trail and the numbers, and they'll bring independent arbitrators in to do the valuation. And so you lose control of the process. And in the court's mind, there's no such thing as sweat equity, which again, to come back to this point on salary versus workload, I often think sweat equity, which doesn't exist in valuations, my equity's worth more because I've worked really hard, so it must be, is actually often one of the biggest drivers towards these kind of, you know, disputes and or lack of agreement on valuation. Have you got a view on that, Stuart?
Yeah, I mean the whole thing about agreeing a working relationship with people around and about the sweat equity thing, and you quite often find that people have said, "Look, they'll make general comments like, you know, I will, you know, you're putting really good work in. I recognise all the weekends. I'll look after you. I'll make sure you've got some equity." But they haven't defined how much equity or when or how, and is it the same thing? And then when you get in the conversation, the guy says, well, I was never going to give you A shares the same as mine. I was only going to give you B shares, and they have a different class. And then you get into all these things, and more and more, the two sides of the coin is these things actually, it's funny that people who are running a business, and but a successful business, end up putting themselves in such a commercially naive situation, and they've discussed lots of things and they haven't put in writing. But the other thing I'd say as well is, the point at which you start going to solicitors is the point at which you've lost the plot, because the only winner is going to be the solicitor, who's going to charge you two sets of solicitors. You're going to have, they're going to charge you huge fees, and actually, fact is, it's not going to resolve the whole situation to your satisfaction. It never will do. The best way of doing this is get an arbitrator who can actually bring some objectivity in, and it's like what you just said before, Kevin, is, you know, they've got to realize, each party's got to realize that everybody's got a gun. Everybody can do some damage here. And the whole thing being is, you just have to come and mediate and get some sort of movement in the middle.
And so let's look at that. So step number one, do a business review. Step number two, look at how the board is functioning, look at the risk profiles of the parties and also their personal motivations. Get those more into the room, get them clearer, spend more time locked in the room till you get it. Defuse the emotion. And see if you can create a joint vision, right?
Yeah, the other thing I'd say is you have to go through the details of why someone's feeling the way they are and why they think that the numbers are wrong. So you have to go back and say, well, why do you think you should have more equity, or why do you think they should have less equity or less money? You need to go back to the logic and drill down to it and get the logic out there and sit there and say, look, you may have discussed this, but you've never actually agreed it and you never put it in writing. Therefore, let's agree now. It doesn't have any standing, because if you go to court, it's not going to have any standing either. So let's look at what has been agreed and what we've got going forward. And then the conversation can normally be with the person who's in control with the larger shareholding is, look, if you want to get this done, are you prepared to move a little bit to get some done? And you give them a little bit of something, and then we can move forward and close it. Otherwise, you're sitting here in a deadlock going nowhere. I got involved in one about literally 6 months ago, where a guy owns 10% of a company that's valued at 20 million. And he wanted to leave and sell his shares. And the company's got the reserves to buy shares, but the owner is just being difficult and saying, no, not prepared to give you that. You're a minority shareholder. That's what the company would be worth if we sold the whole lot. We're not selling the whole lot. We're buying your minority shareholding. And he offered him 1 or 2 million on shares, supposedly worth 2 million. He offered him 500,000 and wasn't prepared to move. And he said, it's very simple. From now on, I'm taking salary. My wife's coming on the board. She's taking salary. All payments are going to be by a bonus. Then there's no dividends. And therefore, you've got shares that are generating you nothing. Right?
That would work. That would work, Stuart. But come back to MAD for a second. Of course, what the minority should do in that situation, say, that's fine. You carry on working and growing the value of the company for my benefit. Because at some point, you're going to either sell it or have a capital event. And all the time I'm here, that price is going up.
Yeah, the trouble you had was the majority shareholder is about 40 years old. And the guy that owned the 10% was about 73 years old. Yeah. And it was like, I'd like the money now to agree. As it was, we did a deal eventually, just a lot of pro and fro. But we did a deal for £700,000 for him. And he got the money out.
Reminds me, Stuart, because that does go full circle. I'm just mindful of time, but it comes back to actually 500 to 700. If you stop and think about it, if you can defuse it again, often that is, it's the tax breaks that can drive that. So if you structure it correctly, what looks like a big gap, because you get, you know, if you do pension or trail out salaries and all the company buyback, often there's 20 to 30% tax. That is the answer to how you bridge that gap in many, many circumstances.
Yeah, and that's part of the whole thing. But what was important was a few people are trying, this is interesting, and this is the other point, they try to bring in arbitrators who knew the parties. their accountants and things like this. And all parties said, oh, but you're working for him, so no one was objective. It's when they went to someone completely separate, unobjective, and came in, who had no axe to grind, who both parties knew wasn't on one person's side or the other, that they actually got some hard talking done. Yeah. And both parties agreed, actually, they wanted this issue to go away. And that's when we got some movement in the money.
Which is really the contention here. We like to work for the company, and you start with the business review and the opportunity, which then creates the independent valuation for the company. You can then do the gap analysis, but you know, what would you like it to be worth versus what it is worth today? And then that then brings in the perspectives, and also working for the company, you can point out each side's leverage position. It doesn't always solve it, but it's better than going to the courts first off and can unlock that deadlock. Sometimes we've done that, and we've actually found the conclusion is, do you know what? Neither of us are right. It's time to sell the whole company because we've got the opportunity elsewhere. We're never going to create absolute alignment. There's no point in falling out on it. The value's good. Let's do 100% sale. Bear in mind that minorities are at discount. 100% is normally pro rata across all the shareholders. So that can be a conclusion in itself. So yeah. I think we've taken up enough of your time today, everybody listening. We've got various guides on valuations. We've got a guide on company buyback, and there's an article that goes with this podcast. Just to finish up, if you've got any questions, please email myself or Stuart. More than happy to chew the fat on valuations and arbitration and all business reviews. Stuart, have you got any final words you want to cover before we finish up?
The only thing is, prevention is better than cure. If you're a director now and haven't got a shareholder agreement that cites what's going to happen in the event that you decide to go different directions or something becomes ill, it's something you need to get put on your to-do list and give it a high priority.
I like the thinking, Stuart. Really appreciate the time today, and we'll catch you later. Thanks all.